Brent, have you and I even spoken a word to each other since Singleton?
No, no, I don't think we have. Oh, no, no, we were at Macworld.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's good to talk to you.
Isn't that an interesting fact that we've gotten from a handshake deal over a beer to a shipping app, and we've spoken voice to voice only at Macworld, where we'd spent about 10 seconds talking about Vesper?
Yeah, sounds about right. Yeah. Yeah, it is amazing.
I hope we're recording.
And we're live.
Jackass has just jumped right into the good stuff.
I'm going to get a short guy to punch you in the nuts, guy.
Why a short guy?
Didn't you watch the show last night?
Yes. Oh, that. Okay. Yeah. Didn't I? Yeah. You know I did. Right. Forgot about that. That was a good episode.
Oh, that reminds me, John. Now we need to talk about branding.
It wasn't really a branding issue. What, the SCMP thing?
Well, what I thought was interesting is that a company whose job is to market and, well, I guess not brand, but market things, they can't handle their own image.
Right. That's obviously, I mean, that's, it's clearly the, I mean, that's the, you're
stating the
humor
the obvious.
Yeah. Right. Well, not but, even the humor, though. I think it's the foreboding.
Sure. Good. Yeah.
I thought it was interesting that nobody, I kept expecting one of the characters to point that out and nobody did. So it seemed like that was completely acceptable.
Right. It's
supposed
to be.
Well, I think that's part of the thing is that nobody recognizes it. Like they're so incapable of thinking about it in that way that they, you know, nobody even brings it up.
The cobbler's children have no shoes.
Right. We're just going to talk about Mad Men.
So welcome to our Mad Men podcast.
So a handshake deal at Singleton. How did that start, Brent?
Well, let's see. Some of the details are murky and lost to history, surely.
lost to history? They're lost to the bottom of a glass is what they're lost to.
AKA history. the basic gist for me is I was looking for something to do besides what I was doing, my then current job. So I was... thinking it'd be really fun to work with some other people. And working with Dave and John sounded just like, you know, the perfect power trio, right? You know, we all have our different roles and we could make something really awesome. It turns out I was right about that. So
was that before or after the Rands talk about developer, designer, dictator at Singleton?
It was before, but then hearing that, I'm like, yeah, of course. Yeah.
That's it was exactly literally
what we have. Yeah.
We ended that meeting so that we could go to the last talk. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, that just immediately validated, what we had put together. And that was very cool. So we knew we were right on. And then a little while after, I ended up quitting the job I had and just saying, you know, I'll just do this full time because this is way fucking better. that's pretty much the story.
What was the idea? Like, why did you just want to work together or did you have an idea for an app? Which came first?
No, Brent had the idea. Brent seemed to have the idea. He came into Montreal. I mean, I don't think he quite said it in so many words, but it seemed like he came into Montreal wanting to pitch me and Dave and somehow foreseeing that the three of us would work well together. Actually, and he even said, but I have no idea what it would be. What do you guys want to make?
Yeah, I didn't have any specific app idea. I think I had talked to Dave about it a little bit beforehand. And, but boy, that's definitely lost at the bottom of a glass of something. I don't remember.
I remember that conversation. We were drinking and you had said it would be great to work on stuff and it would be great to work on stuff with you and John. Of course, I'm going to say yes to that.
Right. And of course. Yeah.
I just assumed that after that it was forgotten. I think you had sent an email to John, but we'd never really talked much about it. And it wasn't until Singleton that we actually discussed the idea.
Yeah.
The app idea itself was John's idea. I want to say you pitched it, John, to somebody else at Singleton the previous year.
No, it was a long time before that. It wasn't even really a pitch. It was that I had I showed it to Coy Vinh years ago after Coy left the New York Times. And I think Marco Arment, not quite like with Brent. Where Brent said, look, I think the three of us should make an app. It wasn't that type of thing. It was, look, I like you guys. You're my friends and like your taste. What do you think about this idea? And if they had really bid on it, then maybe one or the other of us would have worked on it together, but it just never went anywhere. And then Koi went on to make what's it called, Mixel, and I don't think Marco's done anything in the last
Marco's years. Sold your idea already,
right? Yeah, he sold Vesper.
Specifically, it was Justin, because Justin came to me after I had left my last job and he left his last job. Oh, he'd come to me and he had said, there's this thing that John had mentioned to me. Would you want to do that as like a kind of a vanity project? Let's just see if we can do it, something to kill time. And so we started working on that. He had to duck out. And so I was left with some design work, but nobody to work on the thing. So when we were talking about doing an app, it seemed like a natural jump to go back to that.
So what form did you carry this idea around in, John? Was it just floating around in your head, or did you have?
I actually have. I'm going to bring it to WWDC next week. I actually have a notebook from 2009 where I've got about 20 or 25 pages of notes. Some of it surprisingly still works, and some of it was way, way different than what we ended up doing. But the basic gist of it was exactly what we turned out. The basic gist was text notes and one master list of notes, like iTunes. iTunes is the model. Remember, and the old iTunes where it was just music, where you've got all music. I don't know what they called it. What they call it? Library, I think. But it just meant every single song in iTunes. And then playlists. But then instead of folders, where if you put something into a thing in the source list, then that's the only thing it's into, it would be tags, so that it could be a one-to-many relationship. Mm-hmm. One item could be in many different tags, and then just dragging up and down for priority. And then that's the basic idea. But what's funny is that Dave and just so one thing I strongly believe in, I really do, is that ideas are not worth that much. Ideas are just. I forget the old adage, but it's, they're just a multiplier of hard work that you idea itself is not worth that much, and you shouldn't really hang on to it. So I don't know. I had the idea, and I always thought it would be a good way to organize your stuff. And so I didn't keep the idea super secret in the hopes that I would eventually work on a team that would build it. I would just tell it to people if they ever asked me, do you have any ideas for an app? And so that's what I forgot about that, but I told Justin about it when Justin was looking for something.
I've heard you explain that idea before too. You may even have said it publicly, like on stage someplace.
Right. There's no use worrying about ideas being all that precious, because it's so far away from having an actual product.
Yeah.
The idea is still there. When I describe it, in a little elevator pitch like that, that does sound like Vesper. But what we actually have feels, I mean, 1,000 times different than what I was thinking at the outset, and all for the better.
Yeah. I mean, the idea is like, let's build a car that drives really fast and handles really well.
Right.
Which exactly. Is easy to say, but not so easy to do. Yeah. So what did you build? Like, how would you describe the difference between the idea and the what you actually did? Because I saw it come a long way, and it's really polished now.
I would say the single biggest difference between what I was thinking 4 years ago and what we built is that I wasn't thinking of it as an iPhone app first. I was thinking of it as either a Mac app or a web app, but something that you would use on a big screen. And so doing it as an iPhone app is, fundamentally changes the nature of it and changes the scope and really, really focuses you on minimalizing everything, because there's just not that much room on screen.
We talked about that, didn't we? I mean, when Justin and I were working on this, we started with the Mac, with a Mac version, and I did the iPhone design more or less on a whim because I had some extra time. And when we sat down, we decided that iPhone made the most sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. You had Jalkut on a recent talk show, and I was laughing because at one point you specifically say that if you were starting a new product now, you would do it for the iPhone. Not even just iOS, just focus on the iPhone first before the Mac or the iPad.
Right. And Jalkut is on the Vesper beta. So he knows when we recorded that, he already knew. And I did that really just to fuck with him, just to try to get him to screw up on air. And he even told me after we stopped recording, he was like, I almost lost it when you said that. I was like, I didn't know what to say.
So what did you bother doing? John. So you had the idea. I don't know what directed by John Gruber means.
I had something written. I don't know. Maybe it'd be better for somebody else to answer.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's a better question anyway. What were your respective roles?
I think of John as the other designer. I mean, I know the whole thing was designer, developer, dictator, and the credit is directed by, but I think of him as the other designer.
Okay, what? In terms of he'd do product design and you would sort of design the screens kind of thing?
Well, I guess the gross oversimplification is that I listen to John talk and then I draw pictures and I give the pictures to Brent and he turns them into software.
Okay, and there's a feedback loop, right, I guess?
Right, right. And then It kind of goes back to Juan and we discuss everything and we talk about what we like, what we don't like, and then the process kind of starts over again.
Well, Brent, I know that you're sort of a design-centric kind of guy yourself.
Yeah, which I think helped a lot in working on this app. And of course, you know, I was part of the feedback process myself, but I would say Dave and John are obviously, you know, the designers on this. I had plenty of, my hands were plenty full in just actually making their crazy shit work.
It reminds me of that Brad Ellis's talk at Singleton where he had the different people at Pacific Helm and they had like the graph of like different people's skills. Mm-hmm. And it's not that everybody has like this one specific thing. It's more that, you know, there's lines that get drawn from here to here. And I think it's very much true for us as well, where we all had our hands a little bit in everything, but obviously we have our strengths and our weaknesses.
There's even a little bit of John code in there, as a matter of fact.
Oh, that's right.
Like one line. But it's a big, huge line.
One massive line. So the part of the app that detects URLs, of course, is a regular expression that John wrote. And in fact, at one point, it had a bug which would hang up the app. So he even had to debug it and rewrite that one line of code.
And then it felt
great assigning a ticket to John. By the way.
And then right before we submitted to the App Store, we can thank him by name, Nick Arnott. How do you pronounce his last name?
Arnott.
Arnott. It wouldn't be a podcast if I didn't mispronounce something. Well, Nick Arnott is doing QA for us and doing an unbelievably good job, but he found a bug in a way that it matches email addresses and I needed to change it. And there was a time when it looked like the last check-in was going to be mine before we submitted, but then we found something else. I thought that would have been pretty cool.
That would have been cool.
I also thought Brent did something very clever with that, which I didn't even tell you, Brent, but I noticed it because the thing I was least looking forward to, because you took my regex and put it in and I didn't know how you did. I never looked at the source. And then when I went to fix this bug and I knew the time was tight and, you know, I was working on it. And the thing I was dreading was all the double backslashing of backslashes I'd have to do to get this thing. And this regex is seriously like, it's humongous. It's like 500 characters all on one line.
Yeah.
But I have it in a version. I have a thing. It's long story short, but I have it in a thing where it's all commented out in this nice long Perl style regular expression where it's more like a program where each little bit of it is on its own line and it's indented and it makes sense. And then I run a thing on it that turns it into the one liner. But then that one-liner, I thought I'm going to have to get in there and double backslash all the backslashes, which is a huge pain in the ass. But then it ends up Brent has a little thing where it sits in the app, the regex, as a text file all by itself. And then he reads the text file into an NS string, and then it's used as the pattern. So nothing has to be double backslashed. It just gets to be used. It's like Perl, where you can use the regex just as a regex without ever having to worry about string escaping it, which is super clever. And I thought super Brent, like nothing could be more Brent than, oh yeah, something very easy like that.
Yeah, well, I certainly didn't want to, you know, put in those backslashes myself either. So I'm like, there's an easy way to handle this.
Can I tell you the other
way that's likely to not have bugs? So
The other thing I found out during that bug fix is that Brent Simmons indents his code like a bum on the street. there's spaces and tabs mixed together, and some of the lines, like, it all looks like it's at eight spaces, but some of the lines have tabs, and then there's a line with seven spaces. It's like, what in the world is going on here?
Well, see, like, on my system, it doesn't look like that at all. Everything's lined up. It's great. I don't know what's different about your Xcode.
Mixing spaces and tabs, Brent Simmons. I mean, my mind was blown.
Oh yeah. Well, okay. I can explain that somewhere. You know, there's some old code in here and mostly new, but somewhere along the line, Xcode changed spaces instead of tabs. And I've been like, okay, I'll adjust to this new world. But what it means is occasionally I've got some tab stuff mixed in with spaces stuff. So whatever. I don't care that much. I care about apps that don't crash and that are awesome.
Not like anybody has to read this stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. We all have our own OCDs. One of mine is always using tabs and having everything perfectly indented. I'm just shocked. Maybe that's why when I'm writing code, though, I write about 3 lines a day.
It's so meticulous.
This is why there's only one of each of us.
Yeah. So go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to drop in an anecdote just to circle back to Brent's thing about our roles and the fact, I mean, nothing was really siloed. I mean, I only wrote one line of code, so we can't really say that I wrote much code. But Dave, you know, would chirp in, and Dave, you know, can you know, spelunk around the code enough to change certain things, you know, animations and timings and stuff like that. You know, he can do the math. And so it's not like he never touched the code. And it's certainly definitely not the case that Brent never had input on the design, sometimes in really, really major ways. And my favorite story of that is that Dave and I went back and forth privately for a long time about, you know, the way that in Vesper you swipe apps to archive them, and that this is like the equivalent of marking it done in like a to-do app. And there's all sorts of ways that apps that have this notion of marking an item done do it. Sometimes they do a strike through, sometimes they gray it out. Sometimes they'll make it jump to the bottom of the list. Sometimes they'll just disappear it. Who knows? So we had this idea that when we talked ourselves into this, that this was great, is that when you'd mark something done, it would like slowly fade out. And as it faded out, then it would go away. And then the item above and below would take up that space. And the idea was that as it faded out, if you wanted to change your mind, you could do it again and bring it back before it disappeared. And we spent a lot of time mocking this up and doing a really, really complicated, well, not complicated, but we did a lot of design work on it. And
I had animatics and everything.
Right, animatics and everything. And it looked great. It really looked great. And then when Brent went to, when it came time to tackle that feature, Brent put up on our glass board, immediately he just like, this sounds like something I would want to just happen really, really fast. And so I just made it real fast. And then we tried it and we were like, oh yeah, that should be like, why in the world would you want that to be slow? No matter how good it looks, that should be really, really fast. And, you know, it was typical Brent type thing, but it was, you know, it was just a perfect example of how Brent would have, you know, a huge impact on the design of the app just by, you know, being honest and saying what he likes. And he was right. That's the sort of thing you do want to be fast.
And there's something to be said for design literacy too, where some developers, you'll have to write like long, detailed design specs to explain every pixel that's going to be changing on the screen. With Brent, I could kind of just wave my hands and draw a picture, and he got it, which sped things up dramatically.
You know, we also made this a whole lot easier with our settings thing, right? Where we have that big P list where you can go through and change, you know, how many pixels away is this or what color is that. So there's an awful lot of getting it. The cosmetics to match the specs that I didn't actually have to do. I could let Dave do it. And that was a really, really big help.
In the future, there will be religions based on that system.
Yes, indeed. And there should be. But that helped take a lot, you know, off my plate. So Dave isn't like, Brent, move that 2 pixels. I'd be like, ah, shit, okay, I'll move it 2 pixels. No, Dave could move it 2 pixels. So
I honestly think that if not for that system and we had to like keep putting in tickets every time we wanted something moved by a pixel, I'm pretty sure we would have hated each other by the time we were done.
Yeah, of course, right, because it would have been all nitpicks all the time.
Right, this saved a ton of time and our friendship.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that's the kind of thing that is pretty common in games, but you've got basically the content is separate. It's basically data, or the layout rather. Can you explain exactly how this plist works so that the listeners can get to religion?
Well, basically, it's a big plist with, you know, everything that would be defined in the code, you know, the margins for something or the colors for something. And the color would be a hex string, you know, as you would use in HTML. So I can define all kinds of margins, insets, you name it. It's just
loosely CSS for app layout. Right? Yeah. I mean, in broad great terms. Yeah.
It's a good, in fact, good. I think, I don't know if we still have any, but it's at one point we even had some of that, you know, that magic auto layout, Cocoa auto layout constraints.
Yeah, yeah.
Stuff. Yeah, we even had some of that in there, at least at some point.
Yeah, we still do, I think, for like the pull to refresh and things like that.
Yeah, all right. So, yeah. So, you know, any kind of number or string or Boolean. There were a lot of cases where, well, we want to try this design and try that design. So there might be, you know, a Boolean to toggle something on or off. For instance, in early builds, we had the tags would appear in the timeline, not just in the detail view. So I think we may have had a Boolean for, you know, would the tags appear in the timeline or not? So we could kind of easily try those things. And all of us, you know, would pull from the repository and build on our own machines. And we could, you know, ourselves try these different combinations.
We were smart enough to recognize early on that there are going to be things that we wouldn't, design decisions that we wouldn't have strong feelings on until we saw it live. And Brent was smart enough to build a system where we could just like flip a light switch and decide which way we liked better.
And there comes a point where when you're working with friends, I mean, and hopefully everybody's working with people who they like. I mean, none of us are, you know, sociopathic. You can't, you know, that we don't care, but you do, even if you tell yourself that the work comes first and you don't want to compromise on the work just for the sake of being nice, there comes a point where if you really feel like you're badgering, in this case, it would be Brent specifically, because I know I told you that I wanted 5 pixels of space underneath the tags, but now that I've seen it, I don't like it. I want it. I know I wanted some, but I think 3 is the better number. Mm. Now make one with 3 and let me see it. If you know that you're interrupting Brent while he's doing something else, then you might just say, I'll file it away for later and I'll live with 5 for now. Whereas with the system we had, we would just, you know, Dave and I would just change it to 3 and see if we liked it better and go.
Right.
And so try everything. I mean, you know, everything. I mean, at the retina pixel resolution, me, you know, worrying about whether the radius on the thumbnail images should be 2px or 3px.
Right.
Which is what, like 1px or 1.5 pixels at non-retina resolution. And we could just play with it and do it both ways, go back and forth sweat every detail like that without slowing Brent down by him being this build machine to let us change a pixel here.
So how does that work on the code, Brent? You've got a class that just reads in these, I guess, I don't know what you call them, settings?
Layout? Yeah, exactly. It's a VS theme class. You know, not that our app is themable, but it has a theme, right? And yeah, it just reads these things. And I have methods like, you know, font for key, float for key, edge insets for key, that kind of thing.
That became the thing. I think the single largest grouping of tickets was the, hey, Brent, can I get a key for this?
Yeah, for sure.
That's interesting because that's reasonably easy to add and has like a huge benefit to everybody.
Yeah.
You know, idea, Brent.
Thank you. And you know, the traditional way might have been, the designers use Interface Builder for all this stuff, you know, and
that's
how it works, right? But it really is, yeah. Our app is not really Interface Builder friendly. It's dynamic and complicated enough that, I think we used IB on the credits view. And even then, I'm still like smashing 2 nibs together and adding a scroll view underneath and, you know, all this kind of stuff.
And we had to do 2 versions, one for the 3.5-inch phone and one for the 4-inch phone.
Yeah, that's right.
Really? Oh, of the credits?
Right. Well, we didn't scroll. Have to. It was easier for me if we
Yeah, it's the way that the additional credits lie off the end of the screen, right?
Right. And it wound up being, it just happened to work out that for me, I could do all of this stuff by editing a P list. But when it came down to laying things out in a zip, it took 3 zips to pull it off.
Right.
Yeah.
So how did you guys settle on the visual design of the app?
Blood, sweat, and tears.
Nobody wants that.
Nobody wants to be the first one to speak. We had gone through a couple of rounds of design based on the original stuff that I had done over the previous summer with Justin. And it was okay. It was, I still think, shippable. But we felt like since we had some time before Brent was really going to be able to ramp up, we thought, well, let's try a different path. Let's strip this down to nothing and only put back the pieces that we need to put back and see where we end up. Mm-hmm. And we wound up really liking it.
Yeah, I think it's very effective. There's very little UI there. Was that a design intent from the beginning?
I think for me, the attraction was that as a designer, especially a visual designer, it's so easy to want to go heavy-handed. And a lot of, like when I'm doing contract work, a lot of my salesmanship in design is things like, look how crisp my lines are and how great these gradients look and look at these lighting effects and these shadows. And so it was kind of a fun challenge to take a step back from that and say, how can we make something that's good without using tricks?
Yeah, you have nowhere to hide, right? It's just your pure style at that point.
Right.
And not having any settings in 1.0 was clearly a constraint we imposed upon ourselves. Now, were we dead set that no matter what we ran into, we wouldn't add settings? No, but it was definitely a goal. And the fact that we hit it is kind of amazing. But by trying not to have any settings and really trying to stick with it, it meant that when we did get stuck on a design that could be, I was going to say
ambiguous.
Solved. Yeah. Well, that you could move past if you added a setting. Hmm. Then it lets you settle on, you know, it's a cheat, I think. I mean, and you know, who knows whether we'll always not have settings, but it forces you to do more work as the designer.
I agree. Our first two versions of Napkin don't have any settings.
Cool.
1.2, which isn't out yet, we added a couple of settings just because, there's stuff like interface noises. Sometimes that's good feedback. Sometimes that's just really annoying for people.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's one where I think if you have noises, you almost have to have a checkbox or, you know, an on-off switch in iOS to let people turn it off because it's so polarizing and that some people, you know, they just get driven nuts. I mean, just crazy out of their minds by sounds.
Right. Like in our case, we use a click noise when you connect an arrow to an item. It's not like we're a noisy app. We don't make a lot of noise very often, but occasionally we do something. And that's good if you're starting to learn how the app works, but it started to get annoying to people who do it every day and they just don't want clicks going on while they're listening to their iTunes or something. So, you know, I think it's good to get out of the gate without any settings and then, add only those that you really require. So I think you guys are doing the right thing.
Well, we have to learn from our users, right? We right. could guess what they'll ask for, but we don't know.
Exactly, yeah. What were some of the things that you thought, you know, the escape hatch that you might have been tempted to use a setting?
It seems like font size is an obvious one.
Font size is one, and we'll probably have to revisit that for accessibility reasons anyway. Not just in terms of being able to tweak, not like should it be 17? Should it be 18? But should it be way, way bigger for people with varying degrees of you know, poor eyesight? Mm-hmm. We had a design for a long time where the note headlines, I think you guys saw this. Yeah, you guys saw this, that the note headlines were in small caps. Mm-hmm. Which looks, you know, but they're real small caps, like real type true typographic small caps. And our friends at Heffler and Frere Jones, who make the font that we're using, did like a custom build system to get us a font where we could use this, because for programmatic reasons, we couldn't just invoke the small caps the way you do on the Mac. You had to, you know, we really needed separate fonts, and they bent over backwards for us. And I loved the way it looks. I still do, but it clearly was sort of like sounds in the interface. It wasn't going to work for everybody. And so, you know, if it's and I don't regret changing it. I think it was the right thing to do for 1.0 to go to, you know, proper up, you know, we still use semi-bold for the title, but to make it stand out, but it's just upper and lowercase like you would expect.
Right.
So this I'm convinced that as soon as we add settings, John's going to ask for small caps.
Oh, definitely. That's the first setting right at the top.
You never get the sense that you're offsetting choices to users just because you couldn't be bothered to come up with them. All the stuff that you're doing here, you made your opinion in terms of how you wanted it to be used.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, and you've got to, you know, testing, obviously, a lot of stuff changed over the last month through having an active and really, really smart group of testers. And I'm sure that after we release it, it's going to change a lot in the next month, 2 months after we have it out in the field based on, you know, real people using it. And I'm sure there's tons of people who are going to run into things and think of things that none of us, you know, happened before. I mean, that happens to every app.
And that's the difference between art and design. With art, it's we would sit around thinking up what we think is the best way, and we would do all of those things and just put it out into the world. But we have to think about what people are really going to do with this thing, and we have to listen to that feedback and start incorporating that into our workflow and how we envision the product.
And also, by not having settings, you don't get in a situation where, oh, you can have Dave's way of doing something and John's way of doing something. You're forced as a group to make a decision for the app.
Right. I mean, we're the caretakers, I think, and it is our job to make these decisions. We should make them informedly, but ultimately we need to make as many of the decisions as we possibly can.
Yeah, having been involved in that process, you guys were remarkably fast. You had like daily builds and something pretty big would change every day. Always addressing the feedback from a lot of really smart people in the beta group.
That's Brent. That's all Brent. We would hand things off to Brent saying, here are the things we want to change. And that they did just happen. It's incredible.
He would close tickets before you opened them sometimes.
I think the record was like true 5 minutes. Because I would close bugs that they never got to see, right?
There were, yeah. I think, at least a couple of feature requests where there's maybe 5 minutes between somebody posting the Glassboard and like the time was they'd post a Glassboard within 5 minutes. We would have decided that's a good idea and Brent would have closed the ticket.
That was really interesting because you used one of Brent's products to basically run the extended beta test for the product you were designing. And it seemed to work really well as someone using it, at least.
We used Glassboard a lot internally, too. I mean, that's our primary means of communication. I mean, almost all of my communication. I mean, we were joking before we got on the air that I've only spoken to Brent by voice once since we started this product. Well, once, meaning the couple of days where we were in San Francisco for Macworld together. But we had almost no voice contact. I think I called Dave one time. I was out, on my phone. Remember, I made like one phone call to you, Dave.
I don't remember you ever calling me.
And it was quick. It was like 30 seconds. It was like, should we do a build or not? I don't know. You know, it wasn't even consequential, but it was just easier for me to call you than to text it all out. So we've had almost no voice contact. Maybe a couple dozen emails for things that really make sense to email. Things like, I don't even know what, but just certain longer things where it's easier to do it in email than anything else. But I don't think more than 24 emails total.
Oh, we hate emails.
Yeah, probably less. And then everything else was Glassboard for the team, and then me and Dave sending probably thousands of instant messages. and it was a pretty easy divide there between, you know, the instant messaging was for stuff where it's like we're talking back and forth. You know, this is not social networking. This isn't like the way that Glassboard is sort of like a private social network like Facebook or Twitter. This is, you know, conversation back and forth. And then a Glassboard thing so that Brent could be filled in on it. But all instant message and Glassboard.
And so I always knew if I didn't hear from you guys for like hours that you were probably in some pretty intense IM discussions.
Intense is a funny word. Asleep. Intense is funny because we never really argued about anything.
Well, no, but intense as in intensely productive. Right.
Right.
Like getting a lot done. Yeah.
What do you mean you didn't argue about anything? You must have disagreed.
Sure, but disagreed.
You didn't want to strangle each other.
I think it depends on what you mean by argue. Like in the classical Greek sense, we argued constantly.
Right.
Okay. I think in the terms of anger or a bitter disagreement or unsettled, it really never happened. I really don't think that we have a single thing that we had to, you know, do a 2 out of 3 vote and the other guy
came out feeling sour. Yeah.
Right.
That's good.
Oh, it's kind of amazing, really.
Yeah.
And Dave's the one who pointed out because the three of us are really, you know, all almost famously opinionated and stuff.
Yeah. I would have put money on there being at least like one explosive fight at some point, but it never happened. I think the worst it ever got was like there was one thing we were trying to decide if the thing should be at the top of the window or the bottom of the window or the view. And we wound up, well, like we did anything. Okay, let's try it both ways. And we wound up all agreeing that it worked better one way than the other. It's really kind of anticlimactic in that way.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, because you were on Glassboard, you got an incredible amount of feedback from some very opinionated people as well. And you always seem to handle it very classily, but also you stuck to your guns where you had to and you made concessions where you had to.
Well, I learned a ton from when I worked at Barebone Software, which was a long time ago, seemingly, I mean, 2000 to 2002. But the way that Rich Siegel and everybody at Barebones handled beta testing to me is the model. I mean, I couldn't imagine how it would be worse. And now I'm on the outside, but 10 years later, I'm still a beta tester of BBEdit, and it's still the same way. Which is a careful balance between being open with your testing team and being private. And keeping your plans to yourself, you know, there's a balance there. But one thing you can never, ever underestimate is the power of just silence and taking, let's say a really contentious critique from somebody on the testing team, like somebody who really hates a change. Don't underestimate saying nothing, waiting a day and thinking and cooling off, letting your emotions cool if it hurt your feelings or whatever, and then respond later. Or the power of not responding in the forum. For Barebones, when I was there, it was email. It's an email list for the beta testers. For us, it's Glassboard, same thing. But don't respond, but then privately, internally, take that criticism or advice or suggestion or whatever and think, well, what's the actual problem that this complaint is about? The actual problem is this. So we ignore his suggestion of how to do it. Let's think about the problem, which is actually real, and we can do that. And then you ship a build the next day that addresses it. And I think it's super satisfying for everybody involved, including the tester who thinks, hey, they listened to me. And maybe I shouldn't have been so emotional when I made the request.
John is really good at sitting back and listening long enough to think of something smart to say. And I think that influenced how we approached people. The criticism or even positive comments, just taking the time, sitting back and thinking about it before saying anything at all. I'm from the school of arguing on the internet. So that was a departure in mental process for me, but a very healthy one.
Yeah. Like that was such a good forum with so many smart things said that you could actually just sell that as like a little ebook or something.
it was almost like a masterclass in how to run a beta, because you took all this feedback and you made people feel validated, and you were always very polite about how you handled it. I don't think anyone got into an argument with any feedback, no matter how brisk it might have been.
Speaking of, do you want to explain the icon?
Dave?
Oh, you throw me under the bus.
I'm on the record as liking it, so
I like it as well.
You're in a safe place.
I'm also on the record as liking it. To me, we had a couple of options. We could either do something that was which would have been expected. It could have been the letter V on a plain or gradient background, and I think the App Store is full of those icons. Or we could do something that was a complete departure in super 3D and suggested and looked pretty on its own. Or we could do something that was just an abstraction of what we thought the UI was. And it really is just one half of a tag bubble against the near white background that we use in the app. And that means Vesper does. It focuses on the part of the UI that we think is the most important, and it looked cool to us.
See, I was completely misled. I thought it was Bond walking out at the beginning of every movie in that little round bullet thing and then turning towards you. I thought you managed to capture that in mid-turn.
Well, if we did that, that would be some kind of trademark violation.
You obviously didn't do that, but it does kind of bring me to the question about Vesper and branding and the feel of the app. And I'm curious, how far along in the process did you put it with that name and with that sort of feeling?
The name was Dave's idea.
The name was my idea, but it was, again, when Justin and I started this, we had done it with the idea that here's something we could make, and it would be really easy to get John to link to it. and so a lot of the decisions early on were made in the spirit of what would John like? I mean, it was John's idea and we figured we should be true to that anyway. But I think before we had written any design notes or I'd started in Photoshop, one of the first things I thought of is we should call it Vesper. It just seemed like a good idea for an app name.
I'll tell you, my original, I had a name from my concept back in 2009 was to call it What, W-H-A-T. And it was all because I wanted to run a deck ad for the app that would say, you use what for notes? Question mark. Yes. And
well, what's on your iPhone?
And, killed by cleverness is what that'll do to you.
And I really, you know, but I thought that was such a clever slogan. You use what for notes and tasks? Yes. But then I realized, my God, can you imagine a more un-Googleable term? Like, what app? It would be 10 gazillion mishits. And, you know, of course, now it's a completely unusable name because there's WhatsApp, the I don't know, instant messaging, yeah. Whatever you want to call it, which is, you know, like the number one downloaded app on the store. And they got around it cleverly by adding the S, which I know is like a pun on what's up, WhatsApp, but it gives them a way to make it Googleable. Because WHATS means nothing other than their app. But that was my idea, which was a terrible idea. It was just I even knew it at the time. I knew that it was, you can't pick an app like that just to run the clever ad. As soon as he said Vesper, I was like, that's it. I knew right. it. I don't think there was ever any debate on it. That was one of those few things where it was like, yeah, we're done with that. Great, move on. And we could have wasted a month on picking the app name.
Seems to me that the design almost falls out of that too, right? There's a roof. I mean, you're clearly going after the James Bond vibe. And that leads you down the path of being sort of this refined. Well, I was going to say refined, minimalistic kind of thing.
Almost timeless.
Yeah. But I mean, you could have gone with like sultry women in the borders and stuff. So.
That would have gone over.
But the whole thing does hang together from the icon to the credit screen to the interaction model.
I think it's the name. I think it's the company name, QBranch, I think is where a lot of that comes from. Where it's still the Bond thing, but we made a conscious decision with the name of the company that we weren't trying to be James Bond. So there's no arguments over which one of us is James Bond. There's no like, I don't know, there's no personality thing there. It's clearly about
Brent. Brent is the guy doing the hard work.
Of course. One of you could be the Connery Bond. One could right. be
actually, I wanted to be M. Just.
But we got to skip all that. And instead, our focus is on we are the guys who make the cool things that James Bond uses.
Right. The user gets to be Bond.
Exactly.
Oh, you're sucking up to the people that are buying your app already, man.
But we did, and we thought, you know, but it's just a little touch, like a little thing just to center yourself if you ever feel like you're lost in a design debate is just think, well, what did the QBranch guys do? They were like scientists, and they were serious. They were making serious tools for serious purposes. And, you know, there's a line that the guy in the movie says, I think at least once, but maybe several times. But I know like most famously is like when he's showing the Aston Martin DB5 to Connery in I think Goldfinger, and he tells him about one of the gadgets, like, you know, that it has an ejector seat, and Connery says, you're joking, and he just says, I never joke about my work. And that's an interesting way to approach it. Now clearly we're having some fun with some aspects of the stuff. It's not like we're taking it like, you know, like we've made an app that runs, you know, a nuclear power plant or something like that. But thinking about it as a serious tool that people are going to depend upon centers you on, you know, making it a tool, not a gimmick.
Before we leave the icon debate entirely, you made a good comment on the Glassboard when you were discussing the icon, and you said that you found the divisiveness of it interesting. What was the interesting aspect of that to you?
If we had put out an icon and everybody said, yeah, that's okay, and left it at that, then I would be really concerned. But getting a strong reaction right down the middle of, and I think more of the comments were about disliking the icon publicly, and a lot of people told us privately how much they liked the icon, but it really came out to be kind of a 50-50 split. And to me, the icon's job is to be visually memorable. It has to represent the app. It has to mean the app. And love it or hate it, if you're remembering it, that it's done its job.
And it is an app icon that I can find instantly no matter what page it is on my iPhone. A lot of the other ones are beautifully designed, but I have to spend a lot of time visually parsing that information on the screen, where Vesper is different enough that it almost always stands out no matter where it is.
Right. It is literally it's iconic.
On your dock.
All right. Well, then, you know, right. Ideally you come up with an icon that everybody would hail as, wow, that's genius. And if you can do that, that's great. And I think a perfect, maybe the canonical example of that in the iOS era is Twitterific, where, you know, back in 2008, I guess when that was the first App Store year, and that was when they won the ADA, the first ADAs for the iPhone, for the first iPhone version of Twitterific. And it had the, whatever his name is, Ollie, I think, the bird.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the thing, you know, people have mentioned this before with regard to Twitter and their support for third clients, but Twitterific did that when Twitter didn't have any bird iconography at all. Their logo was a T. Mm-hmm. There were no birds on their website. They had no bird imagery at all. Twitterific took that name Twitter, and it being a sort of, you know, could be an allusion to the noise that birds make. And they did that all on their own. And, you know, you see that, and it's memorable. It is attractive. It's a brand. It's a logo. You know, it looks great on your dock. It makes you want to tap it. I mean, that's great. But how many icons are there like that? Right, there's not that many. I mean, if we could have thought of something like that, we would have done it. But better, like Dave said, to have something that evokes strong opinions than to have something that nobody complains about because nobody cares about.
Right, and if this thing launches and the entire world is talking about how much they hate that icon, I'm happy.
I bet. I guarantee you that by the time this podcast airs, our App Store page definitely there's a. I'll make a bet with any of you guys for any amount of money that there's. At least, I don't know what the number is, at least 3 complaints about the app icon in the comments on the App Store page. Guaranteed.
It's like the app itself. It's not designed to be for everyone. It's very opinionated. It's very bold in how it approaches things. And I think in that sense, the icon does a pretty good job of representing the app.
From my point of view, the icon also wears very well. It's actually grown on me over time. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I'm close to it, you know, but, you know, I look at it every day and, you know, I think I like it a little bit more every single day, too. And I like design that takes that aspect into account. There are plenty of things that look gorgeous on day one and on day two look tired. Right. And our icon is the opposite. Which is
there was a version of the icon that had that effect. We tried the letter V for a day.
Yeah.
And it was very late in the process and it was kind of a, what about this? And we looked at it and we were intensely in love with this thing and we slept on it. We woke up in the morning, we kind of looked at the icon and said, no, that was a mistake. It didn't, I don't know.
What were we thinking?
Yeah.
It was really bad.
It didn't keep.
No. But it didn't create a bad first impression. It just really wore poorly.
I like it because it evokes the interface. And it sticks out like a sore thumb, and that's not a bad thing. You know what I mean? Like it's easily spotted and tapped.
Yeah, and I hope that people will at least assume, or we might even show this at some point, but we went through, I have a whole sheet of different icon ideas. It's not like this was our first idea and we just ran with it. We went through a very, very large number of different shapes and different ideas. One of them was even like a 3D manila folder with like a little piece of paper hanging out of it. It got super literal. And
the wrong thing to do.
Well, of course. But we had to try it. There was a lot of things we did in this process throughout the entire design process and development process that were, in retrospect, obviously wrong. But at the time, we wanted to make sure that we at least thought it through.
Of course. And wanted to prove they were wrong.
Right. And the icon, we went through so many iterations of that. And this is what we felt best captured the app. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned 3D in the icon. This is a decidedly not 3D app. How soon in the design process was that decision made? And was it sort of an absolute, or did that grow over iterations?
It's funny you'd say that. I think that it's more of a 3D app than most apps.
Well, it's 3D in the way letterpress is, because it's not richly textured, but there's a level of play in the way that the words bounce or move around or layered.
And our navigation is all Z-axis.
Yeah.
Very little moves from side to side.
There's no faux 3D. It's a real 3D app.
In a way, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that let's use the F word, flat. we didn't go flat immediately. We didn't say let's make a flat app. We thought let's do three or four different, wildly different initial. This is the rough sketch, look and feel of what it would be. And the first one, I think, was more or less like what David talked about, that he had, based on work he had done with Justin Williams, looked really good, but looked a lot more like what you'd think that an iPhone Notes app would look like in terms of shadows and textures and stuff like that. And then the second one was in terms of like this loose idea that we do three or four that are just wildly different, like make three, four different, completely different apps. The second one was this one. And we just never made three or four because we thought, well, that, you know, clearly this is the way we should go because this is something.
I think we did three or four versions of this. I mean, I've got old comps where it was, you know, different color schemes and different arrangements. I had just shown you guys a couple of days ago, went back and found the very first, again, the F word, flat version of Vesper. And we looked at, I think your comment was, it's amazing how close to the final product that looked.
Yeah.
And I think we found something that rang true for us then, and we just iterated on that.
Right. It's like you come down through, like, it's almost like a logarithmic scale where you're going at an order of magnitude, but you start with the rough picture and you say, okay, this one, but now you do 10 more like that and come up with another level of refinement and another, and each of these levels of refinement are finer and finer and finer. And you're starting to talk about things like, should this, if we draw a line here, should it be 2 pixels or 1 pixel? You know, and well, what if we did 2 pixels, but we lighten the color to make it look a little thinner? And things, you know, literally sweating the pixels on the retina display. But, you know, a couple of iterations earlier, you were talking big picture, like, should there even be a line here?
You know? Right.
I just remember this talk at South by Southwest that Michael Lopp gave years ago, where he talked about working at Apple and he just talked about the process where that it would be, you know, you'd have to do 10 designers would have to do 10 comps and it would have to be pixel perfect. Each one had to be a genuine proposal of this is exactly what the app should look like. And then you'd have to be ready to defend all 10 of them. You couldn't just do the thing where here's the real one and I'll do 9 that are crap. Yeah. And, you know, and just sort of, you know, come on, you'll pick, you know, which one you're supposed to pick. You had to do 10 that were all legit. And then one would get picked and then you'd have to do 10 more based on that one, based on the notes from the meeting. And then you'd have another meeting and you'd take more notes and one would be picked as the direction to go. But then you'd do 10 more at a level of refinement, and I remember his giving this and he was talking about how hard, you know, what hard work it is and what a great hard process it is. And I remember thinking, wouldn't that be great though, to be able to, you know, to be the guy who just gets to say, now give me some more. Which is sort of what I got to do here, you know. And that was years ago, but that's sort of why I've enjoyed working on this so much. And that it, you know, that Dave and Brent never felt, or at least never told me that they felt like I was putting them out, but that I could just keep asking for, all right, that's the way, but now give me 3 options that are based on that.
I've got this.
So how much
painting
of a pain in the ass was it working with John? I cut you off for TikTok. Just, you know, go ahead.
Well, I'll go back to that real quick. I've got this painting in my bedroom that is a friend of mine is a painter and she paints like cityscapes, and it's a gorgeous painting. And it's kind of this almost like super high color pop art meets art deco sort of a thing. And I love the painting. And she also gave me the sketch, the pencil sketch that she did before the painting. And I've got that hanging up on my fridge. And to compare the two, they're obviously very different, but you can see how one is a direct descendant of the other. Mm. And I think it's interesting to look back at our earliest stuff and see Vesper in that same light.
That's interesting. One thing I wanted to talk to you guys about was, I guess I'll call it the kinetics of the app. You earlier described it as sort of Z-axis oriented. But it's more than that. And the other thing that I wanted to ask about was the gesture-based navigation, which changed a lot during the beta process. What were you going in? Did you have strong opinions on the gesture-based stuff? And how did that evolve during the process?
Well, it's not gesture-based so much as direct manipulation.
That's a better way
of putting it.
Really good point, and that's important. And can I take that from there just for a second? So, for example, if you want to archive a note, you swipe on it from right to left. But it's not like you do a swipe and then the archive happens. As you move your finger, the note tracks your finger on the screen exactly as you move. So you're actually the idea in your head. And I think in terms of feel, it's a huge difference. Now, compare and contrast that with like the standard UI table view in iOS where you can swipe on it and it makes a delete button appear. That's a gesture. You're not moving anything. You just do a swipe on the row and a delete button appears. Whereas in Vesper, I don't think we have a single gesture that works like that. Everything where you do a swipe, you're moving the actual thing, which I think is a huge plus in terms of making it feel nice.
Yeah, I think that's a great distinction.
It's not an abstract command.
I think that's why I used it I think that's why I picked kinetic to describe it at first. And then stumbled by saying gesture, but you're right. It's very feels very direct. When you grab the list view and you slide it aside, it just feels like you're dragging the entire panel to the side.
Well, that's how swirl views work, and it feels so much better to be consistent in that way. If you touch something and move it, it should move.
Yes,
right. And I'll tell you for an example. I've played with a Microsoft Surface, which is that big table thing, and it predates the iPhone by years. It had a lot of things. Number one, it was laggy. And I think it was because it was laggy, it had a lot of things where to scroll, you would do swipe gestures and you would do it in the same way. But because it wasn't tracking, it just didn't feel fun, you know. And there's a lot of reasons Microsoft Surface didn't catch on. But I think there's a reason a lot of touch screens before the iPhone didn't catch on was that swipe gestures that aren't really tracking the thing are just, they're like shortcuts. They're like keyboard shortcuts. Mm-hmm. You know, you just have to know to do it and then something happens as opposed to feeling like you're directly manipulating the objects that you see.
I had never in my life actually written code that used the pan gesture recognizer before. And that was eye-opening to me. I'd always done swipes and taps and stuff. I love the pan gesture recognizer. I want to make everything panable. But that's the key to making it feel alive. You know, that's the direct manipulation right there, the technical side of it. Yep.
At one point, pretty late in the process, you inverted the swipe to archive. I don't want to call it a gesture, but
action.
Movement. Action. You used to swipe it off to the right.
I can take this. Yeah. Our initial builds and all the ones we used internally before we went outside, the three of us, all had to archive an item. You would swipe it from the left to the right. And we didn't have anything happen on a swipe from right to left. And our thinking was we weren't sure what we wanted to do. And our ideas were maybe swiping the other way would do the exact same thing. So you could archive an item by swiping either way. And there's some precedence in that with the UI table view where you can get that delete thing to show up by swiping, putting a swipe shortcut on it either way, even though the delete button always shows up on the same side. But that seemed a little weird. It seemed like if you're going to go with the kinetic model and that there's a little hidden archive label and an arrow that shoots it over on the side, it seems weird that it would be on both sides. We also thought maybe that would be a shortcut for delete, to swipe the other way. But then that seemed dangerous because in a standard UI table view, you can swipe either way to make the same thing happen, get a little delete button. Whereas we were going to think about maybe having one way be an archive, which is safe because it's sending your item to a nice safe place, and the other way be a delete. Now, it wouldn't be like an instant delete. There'd be some kind of confirmation dialogue or something like that, but it just seemed like maybe it would be an unpleasant surprise. Mm-hmm. But what wound up happening is, and this is the reason it's great to have a great beta testing crew, is that testers really seemed adamant that they wanted a swipe from left to right to open the sidebar, that they didn't want to have to hit the hamburger button. Mm-hmm. And that it just felt like with all the other, you know, the kinetics, I haven't used that word, but that is a good word though.
Go with it.
Because there's like a solidness to it. Like we'd often, I would often talk in these broad terms to Dave about make it feel like a thing, you know, like an actual thing that you're dealing with. With all the other ways that the app felt like a thing, it just made sense for the, as we call it, the timeline of notes to feel like a thing. That was one thing where there are a lot of testers who felt strongly about it and none who argued the other way. And when we implemented it, it made them happy. But that meant that our only two options, if we were going to let you swipe the timeline to open that sidebar left to right, we could either not have swiping left to right on notes to do something, or we could have it like you'd have to sort of do it from the edge only to move the whole timeline and do a thing in the middle. And that seemed a little fiddly, mm-hmm. I would say.
I think I suggested that one. And I was wrong because I think a build got out like that and it was just kind of wacky.
But we could have done what you suggested, though, and played more with the regions of the tab.
Yeah, I feel like you could have done it, but it was weird. That initial one was weird.
And I think this.
Yeah, go ahead.
I can't even count how many hamburger apps, you know, hamburger design pattern apps I've downloaded over the past 2 months to see how they do it. I mean, every one I could find, I downloaded. And some have that, and there's some that have a pretty good touch on that. But I just think, like, in broad terms, though, like it makes it seem a little too fiddly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have to think about this one. You can just swipe from anywhere and it happens. It removes another point of memory for you.
Well, it's also that direct manipulation kinetic thing of if you want this thing to, if there's a button that moves this thing out of the way, you should also just be able to move it out of the way.
Right.
Was the hamburger basement metaphor something that you had to discuss, or was it always involved in the app?
I think it was there from my original designs, and it wasn't because I was super excited about hamburgers and basements. In fact, very much the opposite. And I really tried to come up with a way to do this that didn't have that feel. And the truth is it kept coming back to, we didn't want, or at the time I didn't want tabs at the bottom because that got in the way of other things. And it seemed like a weird restriction to place and a weird visual restriction to place on the app. And it eventually wound up being the right thing to do.
You do it really nicely. Like, you pull sideways, the other one pulls slightly behind it. There's a lot of little visual touches that makes it feel more alive.
Did you notice how the nav bar changes as you're pulling?
Yep.
In the timeline? I think that's my favorite little touch right there.
My favorite is that the basement, I guess that's the term, is slightly shorter in terms of height. In the back. Yes. Like, it's clearly behind it. There's a visual stacking going on.
And I quite love that when you try to archive something and you decide you change your mind and you go back, the text kind of bounces to get you there. It doesn't just smoothly go back.
And it bounces more depending on how far you have pulled it.
Yeah, it's really nice kinetics, not just kinetics.
This could be the time when I answer the question about working with John.
I have an answer for that too. Yeah.
Oh, you should go first.
I said that just to be snotty, but
you know. Yeah, no. So, but it is a serious question. Was it a pain in the ass working with John or with Dave? And the answer is no. And the reason for that is really important. It's a pain in the ass to work with people who don't share your love of quality, or people who don't communicate very well, or people who aren't good at what they do. You know, all those things can make work a real pain in the ass. But if people are on the same level as you and have the same goal and bring to the table what's needed, then it's great. Then, you know, no amount of work or iteration or whatever could possibly
be a bother because, you know, you all have the same goal and you all know what it takes to make really good software. So it wasn't a pain in the ass at all.
Dave?
For me, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, at least it would be disingenuous to not call out the fact that of the three of us, I'm the kid in a lot of ways. I'm the youngest and I'm the least experienced. And of course, to work with John and Brent, there's a certain amount of, I feel like I need to keep up. And it's cool for me because it means that there's no opportunity. There's no room for me to have ego about anything that I do. So it's a very healthy process in that way. But more directly, being able to take this attitude of I'm here to learn and to do my best work possible and to work with guys who they also don't approach anything with ego. The objective in every case and every conversation is how do we make this thing the best thing we can make it? It makes all the difference in the world. Day-to-day working process, especially with John, I think that the perception of like John's involvement, at least I think for me, even up front, the guess was that it would be Brent and I doing the work and John would be sort of directing things in the way that like you think of traffic being directed. And what ends up happening though, in reality, was a really close working relationship with both John and Brent, but especially John on the design side, where we would have conversations, IM conversations, iMessage conversations that would stretch out over the course of 12 hours on a given day. And these would happen many, many days in a row, still do, where we're talking about the smallest of details and zooming back out to the largest of details. And when I said earlier that the gross oversimplification is that John talks, I draw pictures, it's not too far from the truth, where there's a lot of discussion amongst the three of us even that goes into something before Photoshop work even happens. So there's a real sense of workflow and a real sense of everybody's got their place and there are things that we all do, but we can sit down and talk. Nothing is off limits to talk about.
It's kind of interesting that it isn't like we had to feel our way to this workflow all that much. We were pretty close, at least from my point of view, from the beginning.
Yeah, it fell into place.
Well, we all work from home by ourselves anyway, so this wasn't a weird change in that way.
Right.
Well, John, I wanted to ask you, was getting sort of back into app development or product development, was that a stress for you? Was it like a leap? Did it change things up a bit?
Yeah, I've enjoyed it. And it's, all of my product design work predates the iPhone. I mean, that's just a sort of a funny coincidence, but it was 2006 when I went full-time at Daring Fireball and the iPhone came out in 2007. And I haven't done any freelance work or other, you know, design work since then. So
and the last new design work was Joyent, right?
Like, right, which was a web app suite, yeah. Right. Although, you know, some similar notions in here, you know, like mm-hmm. tags for organization and stuff like that. But so there's a little pressure there because, you know, if you haven't designed something for a while and, it, you know, 2013 is a little late to the game to be working on your first iPhone app. But it's, you know, I felt like I jumped right in. And the other thing, too, was the way that our team works is that I really got to do only what I'm good at, which is thinking about how things should look as opposed to actually doing it, you know, writing the code. I'm not terrible at writing code, but I'm so painfully slow and I couldn't do any. I mean, just, you know, way terrible.
Yeah. He's an idea man.
Well, and I'm no good at Photoshop either, you know, other than setting type and writing regular expressions. I'm not really good at that.
We should talk about that. Your typography, your I don't even know what the word is. I want to say love for, but I don't think that's a strong enough word.
Passion.
Let's go with passion. That was a huge influence on everything we did.
Right. That was one of the first things that we kind of hit upon. Although I think I came upon that after you first did the Flattish design. And then I thought, well, what if we made it a typographic centered app? Like, you know, more like, or at least as lessons we could draw inspiration from designing a book than designing software. And let the type speak for itself in as many places as possible.
So you're very influenced by Windows Phone.
And the thing for me about the app is that it is type-centric because, you know, the Retina display and because of the flatness of the app, but you still have information density, which I don't feel like Metro has. There's still a lot of information that you manage to have on the page, so that almost becomes a star along with the typography.
Well, and there's actually a difference there specific to Windows Phone, where one of my basic rules of thumb when I'm designing anything and it's going to have text is to... You start thinking in terms of boxes. Almost everybody does, unless you're designing Ray Gun magazine. I don't know. You guys remember Ray Gun?
Yes.
Very well.
You think of, and which always blew me away because my design always is in boxes. So Ray Gun, I love, never read a word of it because I couldn't, but I bought every issue because it blew me away because it was the type of typography that I could never do. I always think in terms of boxes, and you think you have a column here, you know, it's rectangles. You have a column here, you have a column here, you have a thing at the top, a horizontal bar. And when you start thinking about that as a designer, you naturally want to draw the boxes and then put the type in the boxes. And you don't have to do that. The text naturally forms boxes by itself, and it forms gutters by itself. So you don't have to draw rules between the elements. And a lot of the times for a lot of different design products, you don't need to draw the boxes. The text itself naturally forms them. And so we really tried to take that, you know, as far as we could, including, you know, for example, I think pretty notably the fact that, again, what we call the timeline, the list of notes, there's no visual rule between them. It's just the text itself that forms the blocks so that you can see that they're discrete items in a list.
You did tweak the item spacing, though, to try to play with that sort of boxing feel.
Oh, that's one of those things that feels separate.
Yeah. That's one of those things that we went through dozens and dozens of iterations in terms of how best to let the text form boxes by itself.
Right. And text with image thumbnails forming boxes. I think that was the biggest challenge we faced.
So that's another thing I wanted to ask because I was kind of advocating just ditching images for the 1.0. But you managed to do a really good job with them. Because there's weird stuff, right? Like the entire UI is built around text notes.
The thing that pushed us over the edge on that. You said we should ditch. It's like, screw him. We're going to get this right.
Well, good. Because you did get it right. Because there's weird stuff, right? Like what if you have just an image in your note? Like no words. You know, what if it's there's any number of weird things to do with images that aren't necessarily easy to fit into the UI that you've got. So can you talk a little bit about what the thinking was behind that, besides just screw guy? Which is fine. That's good enough motivation for me. But you know, what was the thought process?
Well, at the highest level, it's not about what it looks like. It's what's the point. Right. What's the problem that's being solved? And the problem that's being solved with the app is you have something in your head that you want to remember. I mean, to me, maybe the main point of the app is that the app works the way I've always felt my brain should work. That I forget things all the time. Like I'll leave the house with the idea that I have to drop off the rent check. I have to pick up the dry cleaning and then go to the grocery store. And those are the only three reasons I've left the house. And I'll go pick up the dry cleaning and then come home. And then I still have the rent check in my pocket and didn't go to the grocery store. And I'll think, oh, because if I don't have it written down and I can't see it, then that's almost an absurd example. But that, you know, take that to everything that's supposed to be in my head. Well, some of the things that I want to remember are it's a picture, you know. It's like somebody says, hey, get this, buy this beer. This beer is great. We'll take a picture of it and then write it down and then I can remember it for the next time I'm, you know, at the beer store.
Or taking a photo of a whiteboard, which I do all the time.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I take a photo of my fridge when I go shopping.
So I take pictures of things, ever since I've had the iPhone back in 2007, things I want to remember later. The problem is with the way of doing it where you're using the camera app, not just to say, hey, here's a picture to add to iPhoto. Here's a picture of this thing I want to remember later. Like remember to do or remember to buy, is you do it. And if it's not something you deal with in the next day or two, all of a sudden 3 or 4 months go by and it's the time you want to remember it. Well, now it's hundreds of pictures away in your camera roll and there's no way to search. Whereas in Vesper, you can take that picture, add the couple of words, just a couple words, just to say what it is, so that, you know, you'll know, you'll be able to search for it. And then, you know, 4, 5, 6 months later, you'll be able to find it.
Mm-hmm. Which is really smart, because you've described the app during this conversation as both notes and to-dos. And it really is a hybrid that sort of lets you collect your thoughts, no matter which, if they don't fit in that precise category of either.
Yeah, that was the idea. I think when we sat down in Montreal and talked about what we should work on, we had talked about what was then the proto stage of Vesper. And I think Brent was resistant to working on a to-do app. And it sort of evolved from there. Like, well, what if it wasn't about what you're doing so much as just like things that you have in your head that you want to capture? And there were three obvious use cases for us. I mean, John with writing and collecting ideas as he moves through the world and picks up pieces of information that he's going to write about later on Daring Fireball. Brent with having ideas of things that he wants to capture in code or how he wants to do things. And specifically for me with music, being able to want to like write down things like lyric ideas, things like that. And we very quickly came up with an idea which turned into Vesper, but applied to all three of those things. Like, what could we do to just build a system where all of those things could be quickly captured for later use?
And what I love also is that it fits different use models. Like I discussed on the Glassboard that I don't use tags, or I stopped using tags shortly, because for me, the most important stuff is the short-term memory or the cache, not writing it to disk. So I just put a couple things down quickly and then I archive them when I'm done. And I haven't found a need for long-term storage yet, but this has nailed the short-term storage for me.
Yeah, I'm also not a huge user of tags, although I do have one for a couple of things. Like, you know, Singleton gets a tag. But I don't have a huge list of tags. Are you guys very heavy on the tags, or do you just have like a handful, like 3 or 4 kind of thing?
I have 9.
You have 9.
Yeah. Yep.
I got about 10 or so. I'll take a look here.
Yeah, like, do you have? I mean, I imagine it was designed, came up sometime though, during the design, that you thought, how many tags are people going to have?
Oh, I have 17. Huh.
Wow. I have 12. Okay. No, it was definitely something that we brought up. And part of it is informed by my usage of other previous apps that use tagging, apps like Yojimbo and Delicious, and now Pinboard for bookmarks, where I have lots and lots of tags. And there are these, like Pinboard and Delicious are a perfect example, where they show the tagging interface is this tag cloud, where it's, you know, you guys have all seen this, where it's like a rectangular block of tags, and they use a bigger font for the ones you use more frequently.
I really hate word clouds.
Oh, I don't like them at all. I think they look so gross.
Yeah.
but it's a way to deal with lots and lots of tags. Yeah. And it makes it look, though, having that is a cue to the user, I think, that you're supposed to use lots of tags. Mm-hmm. And so that you're going along and you're acting sort of like a librarian, and making like this card catalog system of everything you put into the system and cataloging it every way you want. Well, when you're in the library, you do want I'm sure that real libraries don't have actual card catalogs, but you want a database where everything is indexed any way you would want it, right? Here's a better metaphor, is the difference between the index of a book, which is how I think a lot of tagging systems encourage you to go, where you have hundreds of entries by the time you've used the app for a couple of months, or the table of contents, which is really just chapter headings, where maybe you've got a dozen of them, because that's the book. So we definitely set out to design a thing where we don't enforce it. If you want to have 100 tags, and Brent, you can talk about this with the sample data we tested the app with up front, but it'll work. I mean, we definitely stress tested it with a lot of tags. But we designed it in a way that discourages it, maybe, or at least gives you a cue that you're doing it wrong if you do it that way. Because when you're in an item, if you add 2 tags, they sit there right next to each other. It looks great. If you add a third tag, it doesn't wrap around, it scrolls off to the right. The overflow scrolls off, and you can pan it with your finger and see them all. But if you have 5 or 6 tags on an item, you can't see them all at once. And that's purposeful. That's, you know, we didn't get that for free. We designed it that way, though, to sort of subtly discourage you and suggest that maybe adding 5 or 6 tags on an item is the wrong way to go.
Yeah, I don't think using tags the right way if you've got like 5 to 8 planes of why it's important, why this note is important.
Right.
Or you've got a note that's basically like a 12-page essay, which is also not the right thing to do.
Again,
and the idea of tags for us was more about not dumping a bunch of metadata on notes so much as it was connecting one thing to another.
Right. Yeah.
And again, this, you know, I like this metaphor of chapter headings. And so, you know, it should also be naturally useful. And we had this in mind from the outset to use the app without any tags at all, or like just literally just one or two. And maybe instead of writing a multi-chapter book, you're just writing your Vesper library is just a booklet and it doesn't need chapter divisions. It should definitely work fine like that and not make you feel like you're underutilizing the app.
Right.
Which I think it's one of those things that goes, nobody ever really talks about, but I always find it unsettling when I'm using an app and I feel like I'm vastly underutilizing it. Like I'm using two features in this app with 100 features, and it always makes me feel, I don't know what the word, maybe a little guilty, like I'm doing it wrong.
Yeah,
it
makes me feel letting dumb. The app down, right?
Yeah.
Well, I you know what? I think a lot of to-do apps – Not necessarily Vesper, but like stuff like OmniFocus or
the GTD apps.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, the GTD apps. I think there's a big market for those because the same people end up buying each one.
But you need to buy into a philosophy to make that work.
Well, yeah, exactly. So this is what I think. I think people buy those apps, feel guilty, like John is saying, that they don't end up using them after, you know, the first few days. Because there's so many planes of importance, right? Like this.
Right.
You know, they're like gym memberships, right?
Exactly. I think I've spoken with with name about this already. And they blame themselves for not using the app and then try a different one.
Yeah. Why don't I understand this? Why is this so hard for
me
to use?
What's wrong with me?
What's wrong with me? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So nobody blames the app.
I made the joke earlier. It's actually completely true, but I have a copy of OmniFocus and there's one item in OmniFocus and that is read getting things done. And I've never done it and it's still sitting there.
I would say this. I think OmniFocus is a great app. And I think if you ever go to like Macworld or something like that, well, they weren't at Macworld this year, but like I've been there and at their booth and you see it, their users are fanatics. Yep. But you have to buy into the system. And we have, you know, we have a bug tracker. We use Lighthouse for Vesper. And, you know, what's a bug tracker? What's an issue tracker? It's a, you know, it's a to-do system, really. And it's, you know, way more complicated than Vesper. I mean, I'm pretty happy with Lighthouse. I think it's worked out well. I hadn't used it before this. Some, you know, for certain projects of a level of complexity, you need a complex app with a system. And OmniFocus is a good example of that. For people who want to use that to manage their stuff. But that's not that's not the problem that Vesper is solving. Vesper is not a competitor to OmniFocus. I think it's something that OmniFocus users might use for other things that don't fit within the system of OmniFocus.
Yes, I definitely agree. I wasn't saying that to disparage the GTD apps. It's just more that I think that a lot of those, I think it's the same thing with a Delicious Library. I think people buy Delicious Library, don't end up using it to catalog all the books, and blame themselves. You know?
Well, doesn't it depend how much overhead the app has? Like one of the things I like about Vesper is it feels like it has no overhead. I can tag or not tag. O'Malley could write his entire Moto X review if he wants to in this, but I could just put two lines to remember. And I like the fact that there's no expectational debt put on me just by opening the app.
That was another thing we discussed early on, was whether or not we should have a character limit.
Hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Well, that would be an interesting choice.
Well, it was the
why? So, is there one? There's not one that I've hit. So
me either.
Is there a? There might be a database limit, like how many billions of characters you can put in there. Is there, Brent?
Not that I know of. I mean, eventually there must be a limit, right? With the 64-bit machine,
before
so
it cries.
Finally, right. Yeah. I mean, you know, you could, you know, take all the words in all the galaxies and all the universe, and maybe I have no idea.
How much data testing did you do and how did you do it?
So this is where I got to torture everybody in advance. So, you know, I had the bare bones of the timeline and the sidebar. I called sidebar instead of basement, but whatever. Had the bare bones of those two things working, but no way to enter a note yet. So I wanted to make sure that that the database would be fast and would scale really well. So we imported all of Dave's tweets from the beginning of time to whatever, end of January this year, and Daring Fireball linked list. So we had something like 30,000-ish items, 2,000 or so tags. And I just, you know, just kept going over that performance stuff until I made it so it could handle that. Because one thing I learned from years of doing NetNewsWire testing is that there are people who will do things that you just think are really out of control and crazy. You know, I would have people, beta testers for NetNewsWire, who would have over 2,000 subscriptions, or one guy who had that many browser tabs open.
And John Syracuse.
Yes, of course. And so I learned, like, you know, John Syracuse is going to walk right in and do something nuts. Or if it's not Syracuse, it's somebody like him. Not that he's nuts, but, you know, he expects the app to be able to work the way he does. And it may be, you know, it may be really taxing unless you handle that stuff right up front. So it was quite a while before John or Dave could actually make a note and see what that worked, how that worked.
That was a glorious day.
It was pretty cool, though, that by the time we were able to make a note, we knew that we had an app that could handle 13 or 14,000 notes and, like Brent said, like 2,000 tags.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually, as a side note, made me feel like I hadn't wasted my time over all the years by tagging all of the entries on Daring Fireball, because the tags aren't actually exposed anywhere. They're you can actually see them in the RSS feed. There's in some, I don't know, obscure RSS metadata field on each entry. But on the actual website, I don't have the tags exposed anywhere. You can't browse by tag. But as I've gone, I've tagged everything, and I've tagged it stupidly. It's sort of, you know, well, maybe it's not stupid, though. I don't know. But like when I tag an article by somebody, I tag their name. So there's, you know, people who have, you know, only have like one entry because it was some guy who wrote an article for Computer World, you know, 6 years ago.
Yeah. But you know, it was actually
Having a database with 2,000 tags actually came in useful.
Yeah, that sounds good.
It was a fascinating app, actually, using the tagged version of Daring Fireball. I would just walk around in the app going like, oh, what's in this tag, you know? It was
What are you doing? There were two apps before Vesper. One was my Twitter archive and one was the Daring Fireball archive. And both were surprisingly, remarkably interesting to tap around in.
Are these obvious in-app purchases?
Daring Fireball's archive did not prove a good stress test for included images.
Oh, that's right. It was a bunch of pictures of my dog, I think, is what we used for the testing.
And Pixel's still in it in the final release, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I really like, too, is that you show people how to use the app by using the app. It's almost like the Super Mario Brothers version rather than the instruction template version.
I think of it very specifically along those lines of Super Mario Brothers versus Legend of Zelda.
Yeah.
Where we don't take you through a walkthrough. It's just kind of a, look, here's the world you're going to exist in. Here's some examples of how you're going to do things. And now you're on your own. Because we trust that you're smart enough to work it out.
And the app is, in maybe intuitive is the wrong way, but logical and sensible enough that the things that you think you can do. And the examples give you just enough to kind of hint you on your way to get there.
Well, the thing that I hate in you see this a lot. I'm not going to name any names, but there are very modern iOS apps that do this thing where they'll overlay. When you first launch the app, they'll provide an overlay with like script text, almost unreadable script text of here's where this button is, and it draws an arrow and shows you how to do something, and it's almost entirely unusable. Nobody's going to read it, and it's like they acknowledge that the thing was hard to use and this is the best they could come up with.
Well, you can name a name. You can say iPhoto, because then you're not hurting anybody's feelings other than people at Apple, and they don't have feelings. Right, but iPhoto for iOS has that button you click that's like, tell me what the fuck is going on,
which is actually better than Adobe Photoshop for iOS, which needs that button and doesn't have it.
I was thinking, I'll name names. I think it was Netflix is the one that I was thinking of for the first time you launch it
up all over. Name names. Napkin does something similar.
Those guys, what's their problem?
Well, I don't know. So,
well, yeah, but yours is an annotation app. It makes sense.
You're annotating your app.
Well, right. Yeah, what we do is like there's a mode where for the first little time when you're using it, we put a little purple question mark on the canvas items that explain how they work.
Yeah, that's not the same thing as blocking the UI with one screen you can't get back that has all the instructions on it.
That's true, because we considered that and then thought that sucked.
Can I use this as a way just to segue into accessibility? Because I was really happy when I saw the credits and it said Doug Russell there, who Dave was kind enough to bring on Iterate to explain the importance of accessibility. And you didn't only talk about it, Dave. You actually put it in the app.
Yeah, I figured if I was going to talk the talk, I had to walk the walk.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to take credit as the guy who cares about accessibility. We all were interested in making that happen. And, you know, with our timeline and with only three of us, it was not realistic that we could have it in 1.0. So we called up Doug and asked if he'd like to help out. And he was kind enough to lend us some of his time.
How did that work for Vesper? Because it's not a traditional UI kit application. So what kind of work did you have to do to make it accessible?
Oh, we turned it over to Doug.
You outsourced.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, we gave him access to the repository and he knew what needed to be done. And he went ahead and did it. And that was great. And frankly, we've been so busy getting 1.0 done, I haven't gone back to review what he's actually done. But I'm quite keen because I'd like to learn myself how this stuff works.
I don't know if you guys know, but that's exactly what happens inside Apple.
Does it just get kicked over to the accessibility guy?
The accessibility teams take care of it, yeah.
Yeah, Doug Russell is our accessibility team. And he's freelance, so if you want accessibility work, don't go to him because we want as much of his time as we can get, but maybe he can recommend somebody for you.
Yeah, let's pitch that because I'm a huge proponent of accessibility stuff.
Yeah, and I've worked with Doug in the past. The guy is just super, super whip smart, and having him on this was a real joy.
I see Doug regularly too. He's here in Seattle. So
why was it such a no-brainer for you to include accessibility stuff? And that was added pretty late in the game, I think, right?
Some of it was. It was a no-brainer because we knew that Doug would be happy to do it. He had already said yes.
Okay.
And it wasn't going to block us in any way.
It seems like an app that would be useful for anybody, you know,
right,
whatever level of you know, vision or whatever other, you know, accessibility problems they might have. It seems like an app that's, you know, potentially useful to anybody. Obviously, there's some kind of apps that are purely visual and accessibility is less of a, you know, you can't make it accessible.
Yeah, like I want to make Napkin accessible and I don't know what the purpose is. The end output is images, right?
So. Right. Yeah, that's a perfect example. Or I was thinking like Paper, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the sketching app.
Well, I don't know. They made the camera accessible.
Yeah. You're smarter than I am.
If blind people can take pictures, they should be able to annotate those screenshots.
Yeah. But there's a way. I don't mean to say you can't, but and there's certain games that how can you make a certain games accessible, you know?
Right.
But Vesper seems like a perfect candidate for an app that ought to be properly accessible.
I agree. And I'm really glad that you guys got it into 1.0.
Yeah, us too.
Yeah.
What about some of the things that didn't make it into 1.0? Because everything is a decision. Your time and resources are limited. I know people were asking about import, export, and you explained on the Glassboard why you hadn't done that or done that yet. What was the process like for you to determine what you were going to do for 1.0?
Well, we really wanted it to be an email client and a blog editor, too.
Letters.app.
Under the hood, it's nearly an RSS reader. Just add RSS.
Given its lineage.
Is that true?
I made that joke, by the way, when we sat down and said, what should we do? I think I made a letters joke, and I got a dirty look, so I never brought it up.
Yeah.
It's funny because in the months that we've been working on Vesper, quite a few, I mean, the whole knock against email apps is that they're so hard to do that you just, you know, and that because you're, you know, every single operating system in the world has a good one built in. And then there's companies like Google making, you know, high quality Gmail clients available everywhere, et cetera, et cetera, that it's just, you can't, there's just no market for it. But yet in the meantime, it is interesting to me that just in the time we've been working on Vesper, a couple of, I think, super high quality email apps have appeared for iOS, Mailbox and Triage.
Yeah, you know what though? They did what you suggested we do, which was build a Gmail client.
Right. Right. That's, so, you know.
Good on you for making the right choice.
That is, you know what?
I guess for not doing anything about it.
I guess it's just another example of me being right, I guess. Long story short, for people who don't know, years ago, how many years ago was it?
Four years? I don't know.
Maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, it was probably around the time I came up with the idea for Vesper. It was probably around 2009 or so, but there was an idea that a bunch of us in, Brent, did you spearhead it?
Yeah.
It was Brent's idea that we should do.
Brent's idea, you started running it. Gus wrote most of the code. I spent time trying to understand how MIME encoding works.
Right.
That gave me a headache, and that's why I drink so heavily still.
And the whole thing fell. I, what was I? The president, I think my title was. And the whole
you
thing
were actually
fell,
elected.
Yeah, I was. So I guess that's the last. You know, that is the last. I shouldn't say that Vesper is the first time I've come out of my Daring Fireball cave in recent years. That was one, and it was obviously turned out as a wet firecracker. But
well, if you look at the GitHub repo, it honestly it says a suicide mission, but it can't hurt to try.
Right, like exactly. Yeah. We did have that notion at the outset that a very likely outcome was exactly the way it turned out. But the bottom line, I think, as I recall, the reason it failed was that there was no solid IMAP open source library that we could use to do IMAP satisfactorily. So we'd have to do our own IMAP. And doing our own IMAP was just like a Mount Everest of work.
Yeah,
Gus
did start on it and got quite a ways, but with only one kind of server, and things went south. And we were hearing from people on the Apple mail team that we were crazy.
Right.
And
my proposed solution to the morass was, well, let's cut off IMAP support in general and just do an app that only works with Gmail. Like, and then we'll have one thing to target with a significant number of users. And it brought the project to a close because it was all a labor of love. It wasn't a thing. I don't think we had any aspirations of making any money on it. We just wanted a cool IMAP client for Mac. But almost everybody involved wasn't using Gmail. So if they weren't going to build an app that they themselves were going to use, what was the point? And that's what sputtered it down.
Yeah. I think if it had been a money thing, we would have kept going. We would have taken the route. Well, we would have taken the route that eventually added. Yeah. Well, I don't know why we're feeding his ego any more than that.
Let's keep talking about how right John is.
Or how great it is to work with me. Let's get my wife on this podcast.
You know what? Yeah, exactly.
I'll give you a peek behind the scenes. The him always being right thing. He doesn't do that when it's design conversations.
No,
I'll give him credit for that.
Oh, you have a
I contributed all of the worst ideas.
But you're good at triggering the best ideas, and that's key, right? In fact, I think we're all good at that. We follow the McDonald's rule sometimes.
There are specific things we can point to, like I came up with the name and Brent came up with the way the archive thing moves. But for the most part, I look at Vesper as like a cloud of ideas, and who is attached to which one is it's so foggy, it's lost to me.
Yeah, that's the best way to – that's the best projects I've worked on have always felt like that. Like I try not to be dear to my ideas. Like if I have a thought and I express it, then it gets wrapped up in a project, and I feel that's the best way to work.
Yeah, going back to the Mad Men thing, there's your idea and there's the idea. And it seems like we're all pretty good about being invested in the idea and not our ideas.
Which one of you is Cutler?
We're all Don Draper.
God.
Well, it's funny. I think part of the genius that Steve Jobs had was that, and he obviously had an enormous ego, but he had this ability, and you hear the stories from dozens and dozens of people who worked with him over the years, was that it wasn't always his way or the highway, although he acted like it was, because he'd come in the next day and then offer your idea from yesterday that he told you was total shit. He'd say, I've got it. We'll put the button in the top, which is exactly what you told him yesterday. And then he'll just say it as though he came up with it overnight, and then it's at the top and you go on. And so he thinks he was right all the time, and it keeps his kept his view of the universe where he was always right, correct, but he was actually changing his mind all the time.
Yeah. I kind of like that, and I kind of hate that, but
I think it would wear thin over time, and you've got to,
Yeah.
I think it's why so many people burned out, you know, the people who surrounded him burned out. But it, you know, clearly helped elevate the work that he was leading to insanely high levels.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it.
Yeah. We have that, but I think all of us just admit, oh man, my idea was garbage.
That was shit. Let's throw it out. If there was any one thing we got really, really good at, it was throwing things away. And I mean that in a good way. We threw away a lot more work than we kept.
Yep. I think that's the best way to go. We did the same thing with Napkin. Napkin 1.0 shipped, and most of the complaints, which were few compared to the compliments, were that we were missing features that we'd actually just ripped out. So I don't know. I think shipping something very light for 1.0 and then building out is the right thing to do. Because then you build what people want rather than what you think people want.
Absolutely. I would so much rather hear after launch people say, I want more, instead of you got it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I want to leave people wanting more so that we can go do that more and not just give them a bunch of crap up front.
Right.
And it's pretty obvious to me and to us, and I think to anybody who uses the app, what the things that we might put in are. But we wanted to focus on the product we were making. We wanted to make it as great as we could.
Right.
Did you have a timeline for shipping or a time period you wanted to hit or a minimum feature count? How did you know when you were getting close to shipping?
See, 1st of April, that was our ship date.
Yeah. Yep. That
was 2013?
Yeah.
Yeah, 2013. So is it good or bad that we're 2 months late? Probably good, because I think April 1 was kind of an insane ship date. Given when engineering started.
Yeah, that would have been 1 month, yeah.
You know, it wasn't preposterous. It wasn't like, you know, proposing that you're going to, you know, build a faster-than-light rocket ship or, you know, a boil-the-ocean type goal. But it was, you know, ambitious.
That sense of ambition helped us, though.
Right. So I don't think we're too late. We're a little later than we wanted to be, but not too bad.
Well, just like with the design itself, we would invent constraints, and by having to stay within those constraints, we always wind up with something better.
The thing that we ran into, and I've always run into it, and I think it's, you know, it gets back to the way that the three of us work so well together, is that this would happen, and past projects with people who I didn't work as well with, they'd get exasperated at my sense of what I'm about to say, and then that added tension and friction to the team. But what I would see over and over and over again is more or less we would attack the worst thing in the app. This is the worst thing of the things we know we have to do. Let's do this part now. And we'd focus on it and we'd work on it and iterate and iterate and iterate it until it was one of the best parts of the app. And then you look at everything in the app and say, well, now here's the worst part of the app. Now we'll do that. And it's all, you know, some other thing. And you do this, you keep doing this. And all of a sudden you're back at that thing that you just started with that used to be the worst and you made it the best. But now it's the worst thing in the app again. And you think, well, is it good? You know, is it okay? Now it's like the worst thing in the app, but can we ship this? And then we'd all be in agreement. We can't ship it like this. And then we'd work on it over and over and over again.
I think that John and I have complementary forms of undiagnosed ADD. Where one day it would be, I think we should work on this. Let's talk about this. And I, like, almost like a puppy would be like, yeah, that sounds great. Let's work on that. And the next day it'd be something else. And I'd get excited about, yeah, let's work on that. It's very shiny objects and enough days of this and you iterate back through. And it ends up being a pretty good workflow. I think some people might be driven insane by that, but for us, it worked out pretty well.
See, I would say it's the opposite of ADD though, because I feel like most of our days, the entire day was just focused on this one thing. And so instead of flitting about, and I don't think it's ADD to think that the next day it's some other wildly different aspect of the app. It's to me, it's that you've like taken this card from the bottom of the deck and put it on the top, but now there's some other card on the bottom and it just sticks out like a sore thumb.
Well, I should explain from my perspective, like getting to a certain point in the Photoshop document or in the design doc, and then switching to a different topic before this thing is done. The way I'm used to working in the past is with people who want to take this thing and get it done and then move on to the next thing. And what we did a lot of was we'd get something to 99% and then run off to the other thing the next day and get that to 99%. And we kept circling back to what we started calling the other 99%.
So can you guys... You're charging for the app, which shouldn't be controversial, because
I would
it's,
hope not.
Right.
I think it would be if we weren't. And it should be.
Yeah, it's not. It's not a right. It's not controversial at all. I want to talk with you guys about the race to the bottom. I know we've been on the call for a long time, but it, you know, three superstars makes it easy to go long. Can you discuss app pricing and how you're approaching it?
Yeah, I think in broad terms, and I think our mutual friend Lex Friedman had a good piece in Macworld magazine, the current print edition on app pricing in this race to the bottom, and making, I think, a very strong case. I don't want to put words in Lex's mouth, but a strong case that this race to the bottom in app pricing, and nowhere is it more severe than the iPhone. The Mac App Store, certainly prices are lower, I think, on Mac software than pre-Mac App Store, but it hasn't had this 99-cent, $199 of race. And even the iPad, it seems like it's not so much. But for some reason, the iPhone, there's this seemingly intense pressure to be free or 99 cents. And that this is not even letting aside what it means for developer revenue right now. You know, and obviously the argument in favor of it is that you make it up in volume. And it's not a total joke, you know, like the old change bank joke on Saturday Night Live where, you know, all the bank does is make change. And how do they make money? Volume. but it's a little bit of that. When you're only making 70 cents in revenue, or 69 cents, I guess, maybe it even rounds down to, it's, you know, you're getting pretty close to trying to make money making change on volume. But Lex's argument is long-term, this is bad for users. Even if you think you're saving money because your apps only cost $1 or $2, it's bad for you in the long-term because it makes app development unsustainable, and it makes it unsustainable to keep reinvesting work in apps to make a 1.5 version that's really a lot better and a 2.0 and a 3.0 and to keep the app up to date with new versions of the system. And you know, I've just noticed, you know, I think there's a correlation if somebody wanted to dig in on the data. I think there's a correlation between the apps I still have on my phone that haven't been updated to fit the 4-inch iPhone screen and what they cost.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That there's a couple of games I bought for 99 cents and they don't fit, and it all stick out like a sore thumb. Whereas maybe if they cost a little bit more, the developer would have an ongoing financial interest in keeping it up to date. And I think it's a great argument. So we're definitely, we and this is something that we were on the same page with right from the get-go, that we, you know, weren't sure what the price was going to be until the last minute. But we had a range, and it was, you know, this sounds ridiculous too when you're talking about, you know, $4, $5, $6 apps, you know, as high prices, but way above the $1, $2 range.
For me, someone who buys apps, I want to be able to pay to get the quality of developers that I want. If I pay 99 cents and developers can subsist, I'll get subsistence quality apps. I won't get the people, like the best and brightest people wanting to make apps for the platform that I'm using.
I think that the pricing is, one, a promise to ourselves that we're going to keep working on this, and two, a promise to our users that we're going to keep working on this.
Brent's had the most experience on this, though, and he just hasn't said anything.
Well, pricing is difficult, and I haven't actually had that much experience with App Store pricing. I did a couple versions of NetNewsWire, and those sold fantastically well because for iPhone and iPad, both of them were there on the App Store day one for the respective platforms. And that, of course, you know, was just huge. And then after that, I didn't really look at sales figures. And then my most recent app was free. So clearly, you know, despite a decent volume, it didn't make that much money.
We're clearly going against the grain in some regards. And I think we can get away with that in some ways because, yes, we are debuting with a certain level of publicity that most apps don't debut with.
Right.
But long term, this app is not going to succeed financially if it's only purchased by people who've heard of me or Brent or even Dave. You know, Dave's got the podcast. Don't you have a podcast?
Yeah, every so often.
You know, if it's the people who know us, I mean, people who do know us and they find out that we've made an app together, I bet a lot of them are going to be excited and they're going to just buy it no matter what it is. And that's great. And I appreciate that. But if we only get that crowd, then we've failed. We need to have most of our users be people who have no idea who we are, which would be just great. And we're certainly approaching that pricing-wise in a way that goes against the grain. If you look at the top grossing apps in the App Store, they're almost all freemium. They're free apps with paid and paid stuff. But they're also all games, mm-hmm. right? So we're not after that. We're clearly not going to be the number one grossing app in the App Store. We have no mm-hmm. chance at it. We're not a game. We're not freemium. But I definitely think there's room in there for serious productivity tools that charge a reasonable price.
I think for a lot of those apps, they do this thing where they let their pricing be part of their marketing. And I think the path we're taking is to let the marketing be the marketing and let the price be the price and sort of keep them separated as much as we possibly can.
You're not targeting people for whom the cost of the app is the primary feature.
Right.
Right. And you definitely lose people when you go above free. I mean, and you lose people when you go above 99 cents and you lose more people when you go... Maybe when you go above $1.99, but I don't think you lose people after that. I think after that, you've taken off the people who are super, super price sensitive. You know, and it goes back to Singleton, really, with Michael Jurowitz's terrific, absolutely terrific, almost a call to arms on app pricing, which is that don't lose the revenue. Don't lose revenue just for the sake of users. Right? That gaining users without gaining revenue is, you know, it's a sucker's bet.
If you double your price and you lose less than half your users, you're making money.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And you're getting better users. You're getting users who are, you know, who are more willing to pay for quality.
Yeah. Who appreciate value over just cost.
Right.
Right. The sort of people who are going to download a free app and then give it one star and write obscenities on the internet, those aren't the people who are going to be out there doing us the favor of talking about our app.
Yeah. Right. I want the people we want. I mean, if we don't get them, we've failed. But we want the people who, when they go in to buy a pair of shoes, look for what looks like the coolest pair of shoes and try them on and then look and see what they cost. Not the people who look at the price tags. Ooh, this one's the cheapest. What could, do you have it in a size 12?
Right.
We don't want that. I mean, and there's certainly a market for that, and it's probably at the top of the grossing charts, but that's not what we're after.
Right. So, you know, Napkin costs $40. We've got a 4.5-star rating, I think, on the Canadian App Store last time I checked. And I think a lot of that is because we do weed out all of the people that don't really appreciate what the app is about.
Well, by the time you spend $40, you've made an informed decision.
I think so, yeah. And, you know, in the future, we hope to have a lot more, or we will have a much better website in order to inform that decision better. But we get serious people, mm-hmm. and they consider the app seriously, and they write serious reviews. And frankly, we're kind of light on features, but we're building out, and all the updates are free, so, you know. Them getting in early is good for us and good for them, I think.
Well, and you know this. I mean, we use it every day on iMore, and it saves us so much time, we feel like we owe you more money for it.
You know what? I've heard from a lot of people that use it constantly, and even people that are just surprised to use it every day. So, I'm pleased by that.
Do you have any numbers on piracy for Napkin?
No, I don't care.
That's a good answer.
I put in some fancy code that explodes if you try to pirate it. but I haven't bothered tracking it. Do you guys care about
that? You should make it so that if you detect that it's pirated, it's like a dirty napkin.
Coffee stains all over it. It's all like basically illegible. Yeah. That's a good answer. Yeah. Right now it just explodes.
I had not even thought about piracy until just now.
Yeah.
I just don't care.
You shouldn't. Don't worry about it.
The people who are going to steal are going to steal it. There's nothing we can do. There's no sense in worrying about that in any way.
They're the same as the free customers and not the people you're targeting anyway.
Right.
It's a bit different on iOS. On the Mac, you have to manually check the receipt, the App Store receipt.
Yeah.
So we do that, and then, you know,
boom.
We check the signing and do some fancy stuff, and then explode.
I have never once talked to a developer in my life. Maybe I don't know enough game developers. You know, I don't know. But I'm sure there's some markets where it might be. But I've never talked to somebody who said, you know what I did is I spent a lot of time and effort trying to booby trap stuff for pirates. And boy, was it worth it.
Games get pirated like crazy. Yeah, and not to get too close to the talk show after 2 hours of chatting with you guys, but Marco's recent piece about Android development. I think you had a piece too, John, about Android being harder to develop for than iOS.
Yeah, the BBC had a thing. And right. Long story short, because the BBC is publicly held, they are accountable. And there's like a council you can go to with complaints if you feel like they're favoring a certain commercial entity over another. Right. And a bunch of Android users, or I don't know if it's even a bunch. Maybe just one angry person filed a complaint.
The ombudsman, basically.
Well, that the BBC Player app comes out with new features for iOS before it comes out with those same features for Android, and doesn't support all Android devices, et cetera, and so forth. And this council, this sort of like an ombudsman council that found that the complaint had no merit because the BBC development team explained how, you know, in detail, all of the reasons why this is so, that it is easier to target, you know,
it's
iOS.
A rational decision.
Right.
Well, I think every developer we've had on Iterate and Debug who does both has expressed the exact same feeling.
So here's my one counterpoint is that for games, you make the same amount of money on Android that you do on iOS, and they're reasonably portable because the UI has nothing to do with the actual system.
Glad we didn't make a game.
Yeah. Don't make games.
Good advice.
No, seriously. It's a very hit-driven business. What you're doing is just simply better.
Napkin isn't a game either.
No. I'm not foolish enough to try to make a game.
I don't think I've ever had an original idea for a video game.
Do you play games at all?
Almost
Jonas,
never.
Maybe? Yeah.
Letterpress. Yeah, and sometimes Nintendo games with Jonas. The Lego, run around and bust up the Lego things with Jonas.
Yeah. That's fun.
I think it's always good. You know, you guys want to wrap up, but it's always, if you're not building something you're going to use yourself, you're going to be miserable and probably do a bad job at it. You know, so I don't really play games. So obviously I think that's why I don't have game ideas. Whereas I have stupid thoughts I want to jot down, you know, a dozen times a day.
And you do.
Right.
And Vesper makes no value judgment as to the quality of our ideas, which is very nice.
Okay, let's wrap this up because this could go forever. So, John, who are you and where can we find you?
I write a website at daringfireball.net about stuff like this.
I'll check it out. Dave?
I have a podcast called Unprofessional.
Uh-huh.
So Unprofesh.com. You could check that out.
Okay. That's it? That's you? Okay.
I didn't know where else to go with that. Twitter at DWiscus.
Yeah, that's fine. Brian? Oh, Brian. Sorry.
Wow, somebody screwed up a name on this podcast and it wasn't Renee.
I know. I took my thing.
It's not like I was going to easy laugh.
You can find my work at vesperapp.co.
Nice.
And I blog at inessential.com.
A little bit understated from all of you, but that's good. Thanks, everybody, for being on. It's been a blast. Honestly, I could go for like another 2 hours, but our listeners are going to get pissed off.
I can't believe that was 2 hours.
Yeah, I know. It flew.
I just assumed you'd trim it down to about 15 minutes.
You know what? 11 minutes in, it looked at the clock, and I'm like, okay, we're done. I'm done with the questions. Now can we just hang out?